Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by journalist, author and broadcaster, Rob Crossan.
Hello, Chris.
As a travel writer, I'm guessing lockdown's been a bit of a trip, but I saw Elvis Costello posted a thing the other day about your interview with him, about going to New Orleans.
Well, that's how I've been travelling, really, vicariously through musicians and people who have far more access to upgrades than I do. I've been doing a show on Sunday afternoons called The Happiness Map on Six Music, where I've been asking a few musicians, Elvis Costello was one of them, to take me to their favourite place on earth, tell me about it, and play music that they choose from that destination. So it's kind of a Desert Island Discs in transit, I suppose, and Elvis, I'm saying it like I know him. I don't know him. Elvis Costello's Guide to New Orleans. So that has been a partially successful way of getting through lockdown.
We'll come to it shortly, but we're talking about a very unusual choice, Beatles-wise. But first, tell me about when you first discovered the Beatles.
I first discovered the Beatles when my dad was going off to work in the morning, and he worked in Bootle in Liverpool, and we lived very close by. And I think me and my younger sister were very hyperactive, as young children are, first thing in the morning. And he thought, well, maybe, I presume he must have thought, maybe Rob and his sister can dance off their manic, sugary breakfast cereal-fueled energy. And he had an old Bang & Olufsen record player in the living room, which I now own, which he bought in 1972. And I'm now the very proud inheritor of it. And he put on Octopus's Garden and Yellow Submarine, and he put them on in the morning so that he could have a bit of peace and quiet for 5 minutes and drink his Nescafe, and me and my sister could dance around the living room. So it was from a very, very young age. And then when I got slightly older, the era of long car journeys with cassettes, my parents had a cassette copy of Paul McCartney, All the Best, which I think at that point must have just come out, about 86, 87. And I was only then about 7 years old. And so I actually became far more au fait with Once Upon a Long Ago and Say, Say, Say before I heard Abbey Road or Revolver. And it actually took me about 6 months of listening to Paul McCartney before putting the two things together and asking my mum, was Paul McCartney in the Beatles? She went, well, yeah. And so it was a pretty clumsy learning curve. So, but by the time I was 14, 15, I just wanted to get hold of every single tune they'd ever recorded. And I think I achieved it by the age of about 20. I remember for ages having not heard Baby, You're a Rich Man and You Know My Name, Look Up the Number. And finally hearing those two and then thinking, I've heard them all now. It was a huge thing for a kind of slightly OCD adolescent music obsessive.
Very much the same here, because I grew up with the Roy Carr and Tony Tyler book, which had all of the albums and all of the solo albums. I think I owned a couple of albums at the time, and I'd read all these mysterious song titles and with these amazing covers. And then there was this huge section at the back with all the solo stuff. I thought, I'll save that for when I'm older. It's like there was a definite concentrated era.
Have you heard all of them? Can you conclusively say you've heard every Beatles solo album?
As far as I'm aware.
That's amazing.
There's probably some bootlegs out there.
Because Ringo's been pretty prolific, and you've heard all of them in the last 20 years.
Yeah. I can't claim to have played them more than once.
You're happy he's making them. You're happy he's enjoying them himself. But no, you don't. It doesn't require much listening, does it?
Which is, oddly enough, what you've picked. Ringo's debut album, Sentimental Journey.
Look at me being an annoying contrarian. Yeah, much as I have absolutely no time at all for anything he's released in the last 20 years or so, I'm genuinely, without any hint of irony. You know, I've always hated that game of guilty pleasures, you know, because people always come up with something that's really not that naff at all. Whereas I like to think if I'm playing guilty pleasures, I'm going to pick something which makes people genuinely think less of me. And that is what Sentimental Journey does.
Well, I don't. I do get a lot of emails, people saying, oh, can I come on and do this? But yours did leap out at me. I don't know if it is a guilty pleasure. I think it's a great album. For me, it's all about context. What else was happening at the time?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, let's give it the official title it deserves, which is that unless you're going to count the likes of Electronic Sound, Two Virgins, which I'm not going to do, it was the very first proper studio Beatles solo album. It came out before Let It Be came out, and it came out before McCartney came out. So it deserves something there. But weirdly, Ringo himself seems to have entirely disowned it from his canon, along with his country follow-up album, Boku of Blues. Because when he released, as we discussed, I think, when we first started chatting about this, when Ringo released Ringo the Fourth, he called it his fourth solo album. But it wasn't. It was his sixth. And the first two, Sentimental Journey and Boku of Blues, seem to have been entirely disowned by him. And I don't know why, because he was a pioneer. I don't think anybody from the 60s generation had ever thought to tackle doing some standards before. Whereas more recently, we've seen Bob Dylan, who did three albums of it. We've seen McCartney with Kisses on the Bottom. We've seen Rod Stewart, Robbie Williams even. A lot of artists have since had a go at tackling the Great American Songbook, and they mostly received critical applause for it. And I often think that if Ringo decided to draw the curtain down on his career by doing another album of standards, it would be much better received than Sentimental Journey was. And you also got to remember that we're talking here about the man who has the best voice left in the Beatles today. I think he could do a better standards album than McCartney. But yes, Sentimental Journey is a strange anomaly, but it genuinely has, for me, an enormous amount of charisma. It's limited. It's a little cheesy in places. But, you know, don't go to the Sahara and complain there's too much sand. You know, it's a standards album. It's got Hoagy Carmichael covers. Of course it's going to be a bit cheesy. But there's a huge level of charisma in it. And not all the tracks work. Some of them are disastrous. But there's so much to enjoy there. And I really get pleasure from it.
Ringo the Fourth, as you say, he's effectively counted Ringo, the 1973 album, as his debut, and buried this Bukus of Blues, as he pronounces it, is probably second to Ringo, my favourite album. I think it's a worthy solo album.
Very much so. I mean, he was playing with the best Nashville session musicians, the kind of artists where you can't go wrong if you're using those people.
Yeah, and with this one, it reached number 7 in the UK album charts. Number 6 at the time was Abbey Road, and number 1 was Bridge Over Troubled Water. So it was against good contenders. But some of the reviews, Rolling Stone said it was horrendous but classy, whatever that means. High Fidelity said some of the tiredest junk ever written. And again, the Roy Carr and Tony Tyler book, which is contentious, but I've got a soft spot for it. But they describe it as a gawky, badly sung, over-sentimental selection of moribund mombos. All are dispensable.
So mean. But, you know, I mean, the job of the Grail Marcus Lester Bangs School of Journalism at that time was to do this purple prose, preposterously overstated put downs. That was the style of rock journalism at the time. And he was a sitting duck, wasn't he? I mean, of course he was. So poor fella, but he'd had a rough time, hadn't
Bless
he?
Him.
He'd had a rough time when you think about what was going on when he was recording this at the end of 69 and the start of 1970. You know, he'd been in hospital. I think he'd had intestinal blockages. There was all the financial disarray. Magic Christian, the movie. Have you seen the pictures at the premiere where even at the premiere of his own film, Ringo gets completely upstaged by John and Yoko, who turn up with a James Hanratty is innocent billboard.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it should probably go on the record that James Hanratty was found to be unequivocally guilty of the A6 murders, yes, which is what John and Yoko were protesting about. But, yeah, things weren't going that well, and I just imagine that with Sentimental Journey, it would have been a case of Ringo getting a few friendly faces together, like Klaus Voormann, like George Martin, Neil Aspinall was involved, you know, McCartney was slightly involved, and doing something that felt familiar to him and gave him, I would hope at least, a little bit of comfort. It would have certainly given him a bit of structure to his life.
Context is everything. So the album was recorded between 27th of October 69 and the 6th of March 1970. And just here's a quick overview of what was going on. He was in Middlesex Hospital on the 8th of September with internal pains. And this was when the Beatles had the meeting, which has been recorded.
Hello, Ringo. Hope you're better.
John recorded it, so because they all four of them used to be in the meetings. And this is the one where John was basically saying, right, we've finished Abbey Road. Let's talk about the next album.
Well, the first thing is dividing the time on albums. So I said it to you, and I said it to you. And if we really divided, it'd be four each and two for Ringo. So that's that settled.
That's that settled. And you can hear this sort of disquiet going on in the background. And this is where it gets contentious, because then on the 20th of September, the Beatles have another meeting, and this is the one in which John says he's leaving the Beatles.
He wants a divorce.
He wants a divorce. However, there's new feelings, because a couple of comments that Paul has said as to whether he meant it or not, because in April 70, when Paul announced he was leaving, he said that the others were shocked. And John often blurted out outrageous statements. There's feeling that he may have just been blurting it out, not really meaning it. He's done it before. Bear in mind, at this point, John and George had released four solo albums. I'm wondering if Ringo possibly thought of this as a side project. Initially, it might have been a side project, because all the Beatles were behind it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there was certainly, there's a few interviews. There's an early, perhaps early 1970, Savile Row interview with George, where he said, well, you know, it would be terribly selfish if we didn't put 3 months a year aside to do some more work. And I would be absolutely certain, I think, that at the time Ringo was recording Sentimental Journey, he was not thinking this is the start of a 50-year solo career. I think he was thinking this will get me out of bed in the morning and then let's see what happens in 71. We'll probably record again as a foursome.
So the album, which was originally titled Ringo Stardust, another classic Ringo album title.
I didn't know that. Oh, that is awful.
Thankfully, changed to Sentimental Journey. It was released on 27th of March. It was produced by George Martin. Primarily, he said it was for his mum, and he went round asking various family members for their favourites. But interestingly, for a debut album, he used the formula that he's stuck with to this day, namely leaning very heavily on friends and musicians. He approached a broad cross-section of people, including George Martin, Richard Perry, Quincy Jones, Morris Gibb from the Bee Gees, Klaus Voormann, and even Elmer Bernstein.
Yes, Elmer Bernstein, the man who did the soundtrack to Magnificent Seven, Great Escape, To Kill a Mockingbird, and Animal House. So, you know, what a little black book that is. And it's worth pointing out he doesn't play the drums at all on this record.
No, which will come up later from some comments made by Quincy Jones.
what disappointed me researching this album is that I had this feeling when I heard it that Ringo was on one of those big sound stages like Sinatra had and was playing with the band right there and just having the time of his life. And it turned out that wasn't the case at all. I think for every track, the vocals were recorded separately.
Yeah, it's a bit of a karaoke affair going on. There's a few where he was there, but yeah, a lot were already for him.
Well, it was all about, like you say, this whole idea that John Lennon said that, you know, before Elvis there was nothing. as well, you know, there was, and this is what this album is all about. And I've always been a real big fan of, I don't know if you've read Generation X by Douglas Copeland. There's a phrase in that where he talks about legislated nostalgia, and that being defined as nostalgia for a time which you didn't personally experience or perhaps didn't even exist. And I think that's what I like when I listen to Sentimental Journey, because I'm a big fan of those angry young man kitchen sink dramas like Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner and Billy Liar. And I always imagine the mums rather than the angry Albert Finneys and Tom Courtneys. I always think of the mums in the kitchen of the prefabs listening to this kind of music. And when I was growing up, you know, I think I maybe experienced a little bit of that era where Sunday afternoons were about overcooked vegetables, sing something simple with the Cliff Adams singers on Radio 2 and having a bath. And there's a weird combination of 1950s England and 1960s, 70s Vegas on this album. And I find it transporting in a way to perhaps the kind of Sunday afternoons with a joint of beef and the news of the world that my grandparents probably enjoyed in the 50s and 60s, and that this album sort of takes me there, even though I'm not old enough to have ever been in that era when these tunes Ringo is singing were a big deal.
Gonna take a sentimental journey, gonna set my heart at ease, gonna make a sentimental journey to renew old memories.
Let's crack on with the album. And we'd start with track one. And this was arranged by Richard Perry in the US. And again, it was sent over to the UK. So they didn't actually meet for another 3 or 4 years. Because obviously Richard produced Ringo and Ringo's Rotogravure.
Oh, is that the one where there's Ringo's holding a magnifying glass?
Yes.
Yes, that one. Yeah. It's a good starting point, this one. He made a video for this at the Talk of the Town Club in London's West End, and it's him with a hideous, oversized pink bow tie performing in a kind of supper club, crooner kind of way with a... I think there's a big sort of Union Jack behind him, isn't there?
There's a Union Jack in a US...
That's right. And that maybe, I might be wrong, there's a screen showing the sleeve of Sentimental Journey, the Empress pub in Dingle, which I guess we'll talk about a little bit later. But I think the first time I heard this tune was a cover by Kermit the Frog. I think Kermit did it with, it might have been Loretta Lynn on The Muppet Show. Right. But I think it's a wonderful video. One thing that I looked up online, and I think is true, that if you watch this video on YouTube, he's wearing the same black suit he wore on the cover of Abbey Road. I think it's the same one. And there's a huge amount of charm to this. His voice suits what he's doing. It's not too challenging. And as you'll find me saying again and again when we go through the tracks on this album, the arrangement is absolutely superb.
I agree. There's a definite wink in the video, but you can almost hear it in the song as well.
He's enjoying himself.
Yeah. You could sort of listen to this and think, is he taking the mic? And then, of course, you've got the whole album after that. And he's not, it's a wink where he's not saying, oh, you know, I'm taking the mic out of myself. It's a wink that's like, I'm really enjoying this. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, I don't give a monkeys.
Yeah. Also, it's almost a self-precautionary thing, isn't it? I think there's that sense of him wanting to take it seriously, but the wink's there just in case he gets criticised, then he can say, well, I was only joking, you know.
Yeah, so it's interesting as well, because he would have known this probably from the Doris Day version, because this was a massive hit.
Yes.
Back in 45, I think it was. So he would have been 5, and his parents would have been singing this. So it's those memories he's going back to. It's very much a comfort blanket to have that sort of music that you remember as a toddler.
Yeah, I think so. And also, I think he wanted to feel some camaraderie again. There wasn't much camaraderie going on with the rest of the Beatles, and if you believe the Lewison account in TuneIn, then, you know, there were some fairly heavy boozy shindigs round the Starkey house. And young Richard was getting stuck in with the bottles of stout from the age of about five. And so you can imagine that having an extraordinary impact on him.
He was experimenting with stout.
Yeah.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you, beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you, night and day.
And next we have a Cole Porter song written for the 1932 Broadway musical Gay Divorcee and originally sung by Fred Astaire and Claire Luce. It's Ringo's version of Night and Day.
Well, I absolutely love this one. I think this might be one of my favourites on the whole album. There's an absolutely enormous swagger to it. There's a swing to it. The arrangements, once again, are... Sinatra would not have been unhappy with if this was the arrangement. Who did do the arrangement for this one?
Well, on the album, it lists Chico O'Farrell, who previously worked with Frank Sinatra. However, well, according to Bill Harry, Ringo asked Count Basie to write the arrangement. And according to him, the finished score arrived 5 days later, but he wasn't listed on the album cover. So it might be a Count Basie arrangement.
Well, if I had done an arrangement with that much snap and crackle and didn't get a credit, I would be highly annoyed. It's exactly what the whole album should be like. I mean, the old Sentimental Journey gets a little bit maudlin in places, and I think if Starkey had stuck to just doing the real Sinatra swings numbers, I think the album would have hung together a little bit better. So, yeah, this one for me is a bit of a high point. It's superb. But Ringo's voice can handle it more than adequately, I think.
Yeah. If the Beatles had split a couple of years ago and Ringo released this album now, it would be on ITV, primetime Saturday evening.
An audience with.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that when Sentimental Journey came out, Ringo did go to Vegas to see Elvis. I think he met him.
Yeah,
and he was approached to do a contract series of shows in Vegas, and he turned it down. It never really got off the starting blocks, because I would imagine, being only 30, as he would have been at the time, he maybe thought, I'm a bit young for this. I'd rather explore my options before I become Engelbert Humperdinck. But actually, I can imagine 1971, a six-month residency for Ringo would have been a huge success if he'd chosen to do that.
Yeah.
But I see why he didn't, because I think it would have been quite limiting for him in terms of what would you do next.
Yeah. Well, he'd already planned Boca of Blues while he was recording this. He knew he was going to do the country album.
Okay.
So I think this was very much a one-off, which is why I'm wondering if initially he thought it might have been a side project.
Yeah.
I don't think he was thinking of this as a career.
No, I mean, you've got to be exploring your options. And again, you know, we're coming at it with so much hindsight. And Ringo, the oldest of the Beatles, but barely 30 when he was doing this. Why shouldn't you, at that point in your life, be allowed to fail? Not that I think Sentimental Journey is a failure, but all artists must be allowed to fail. And I think there's less and less tolerance for that today. And if anyone should be allowed to fail, it should be an ex-Beatle. And Sentimental Journey wasn't a failure, but I admire his bravery in trying to do something that absolutely nobody had tried before. Yeah, and like I say, he was a pioneer, because it's been done a hell of a lot since 1970 by big stars.
This was the first song to be recorded for the album on the 27th October 69, 3 days before the release of Cold Turkey and 4 days before the Beatles released Something and Come Together. It's still very Beatles-centric.
How extraordinary that four different people within the space of a few days can release such wildly different interpretations of music. I mean, can you imagine if, let's say, John Entwistle, Pete Townsend, and Roger Daltrey all released solo stuff within a week? I have a feeling that would all sound fairly broadly similar.
Yeah.
Or Dennis Wilson, Carl Wilson, and Brian Wilson. Yeah, the idea that three friends who had spent the preceding 15 years together were now so disparate in their creative tendencies is, it's little short of alchemy to me.
Let's talk about Ringo's vocal range. My theory about this album, he previously had songs written for him by arguably the best composers of the 20th century. So he was looking, well, who do I get that will compare with them? Hence why he's picking all these classic songs. But of course, a lot of the time, John and Paul were writing for him, knowing his range. And I think, you know, he's got a wider range than we give him credit for. Some of these songs, he really does go for it.
He does. You cannot fault the exuberance in the performances. He has, I think, a very mellifluous baritone at times. And what I like is the range where he can go from what we first heard on Good Night, and that kind of voice comes again on this album, the kind of soothing, almost avuncular, paternal sotto voce. I've said that wrong. We've also got the very brassy, confident, controlled lead vocalist. It's a bit of a bellow, but it's not a charmless one by a long stretch. And then you've also got the kind of weary, hangdog, act naturally vocal, which also emerges here. Yeah, he does have a range, and the idea that he is just your drunk uncle at karaoke is unfair, apart from one track on Sentimental Journey where he really is your drunk uncle. But we'll come to that one later.
Why do you whisper green grass? Why tell the trees what ain't so? Whispering grass, the trees don't have to know. No, no.
Next we have a song arranged by Ron Goodwin, who's written 70 scores, including the Margaret Rutherford Miss Marple movies and later Hitchcock's Frenzy. It's Whispering Grass, brackets, Don't Tell the Trees.
Whispering Grass, yeah. Well, we were talking earlier about arguments against the 70s, and I wasn't born when this came out, but I can absolutely guarantee the first version of this I heard was sung by two of the blokes from It Ain't Half Hot Mum. And that got to number one. Number one.
Yeah.
What was going on in that decade? I have heard some better versions of it since. One by the Ink Spots from the 40s, which I would imagine would have been the version Ringo would have heard. We're back on the White Album's Good Night voice here, aren't we? It's soothing, it's gentle. I think Ringo really means it. It's one of those tracks where what he lacks in vocal ability, he makes up for in absolute conviction and passion and love for the song. And that does make up for an awful lot of what might be lacking elsewhere.
I agree. It's quite a low-key performance. You do realise he actually means it. I do love the way he splutters the line, told the blabbering trees.
He has a lot of chutzpah and a lot of conviction as a storyteller. And Whispering Grass, he's kind of telling a story, isn't he? And I'm sure he would hate it if I said, now, I can see why you got the Thomas the Tank Engine gig. But it is that ability to tell a story in a universal, childlike way, which isn't patronising or condescending or creepy.
And Ron Goodwin's string arrangement is something rather lovely.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Big brass swell at the end as well.
Yeah, I would happily listen to an instrumental version of this, but that does not detract from Ringo's vocal effort. And again, you know, you just wonder, would he have done a better job if they'd pulled it together to actually have him on a soundstage I think there's no doubt it would have been even better.
And finally, yes, I mean, I have to admit, we did own the Donna Stellan Windsor Davis version.
Is that who it was?
In the 70s. Yeah.
I mean, I've never really seen it. It ain't half hot, mum. But from what I've been told, it was not as good as On the Buses. And I think that seems like quite a damning critique.
Pack up all my cares and woe. Here I go, singing low. Bye, bye, Blackbird. Where somebody waits for me. Sugar is sweet, so is she. Bye, bye, Blackbird. No one here can love and understand me. Oh, what hard luck stories they all hand me. Make my bed and light the light. I'll arrive late tonight. Blackbird, bye-bye.
Arranged by Morris Gibb, we have Bye Bye Blackbird.
Oh, yes. Well, this is pure music hall. This one. There's a sort of George Formby ukulele going on at the beginning, which is fantastic. And really, what listening to this, I really feel that Ringo's more leading a sing-along. This one takes you to the Starkey household circa 1949, more than any other track on the album. This is a family sing-along album, and there's nothing wrong with that. Really worth talking here about the fact that McCartney also did this one on Kisses on the Bottom.
Yeah.
Now, which one do you think's better?
They're very different, aren't they? I do lean to this version, I have to say, because a lot of Paul's one, they're very low key and very whispered, and it's sort of late night.
Yeah.
It's sort of late night with your loved one.
Make my bed and light the light. I'll be home late tonight, Blackbird.
But this is sort of late night with your boozy family.
Exactly.
Pissed out their heads.
Make my bed and light the light. I'll arrive late tonight, Blackbird.
I totally agree. There's something quite... I mean, I see what McCartney was trying to do on Kisses on the Bottom, but it all feels quite casual. Yeah, and like I say, you know, I've got no... during lockdown, I'd love a late night in with a loved one. But I'd also like a family boozy sing-along as well. So I'm kind of pining for both at the present time. But yeah, I'll take Ringo's version over Paul's of this one every time. He's trying harder.
Yeah. This is one of the highlights for me, I think. Morris Gibb does an amazing job on the arrangement for this. And he and Ringo, of course, were really good friends. They'd been on holiday to Morocco together. And I don't know if you've seen this footage of Ringo and Morris home videos.
No.
On YouTube. Oh, have a look.
They're so just is this them around. Knocking about Marrakesh, or what are they doing?
No, they're basically doing improvised sketches.
Oh, wonderful. So this was maybe an audition or a demo for a sketch show they might have done together.
I would love to see
Morris and Ringo's laughing.
I would love
I'd
to see
watch that.
I think it was just purely for the crack.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, have a look. They're messing around in the swimming pool. There's a sketch where Ringo's dressed as some kind of jester.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, meet the people. We have a very interesting guest for you. Prince Valentine from Yorkshire. He's travelled all the way down on the 8:30 horse. I'll just call him over, and we'll ask him a few interested and pointed questions. Prince Valentine!
Hello.
Hello, sir.
How are you?
All right, thank you very much.
Yes.
You're very kind.
Yes.
Well, Prince, certainly wonderful for you to do our show for us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, really.
I'm sure all the people here in Bradford are really looking forward to this sensational conversation you're going to give us.
Well, it's such a hell of a journey down here, but mind you, I haven't travelled out of York for so long.
Yes.
Great pleasure.
How is the road?
Oh, still there. Yeah.
They put a lot of effort into it, but
is that on YouTube?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll definitely take a look for that. Fantastic. It can't be worse than... I'd rather watch that than almost any of Ringo's full, proper, paid-for movies. You want to watch Ringo and Morris mucking about in a swimming pool, or do you want to watch Sextet? There's only one sensible answer to that question.
Have you seen Sextet?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen it. Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, it's disturbing. It's really disturbing. A sort of clearly infirm 83-year-old Mae West, who I don't think even really knew she was making a film. It's unbelievably bad. It's not even funny. You know, you think, well, this could be funny to watch it while I'm drunk, you know, like watching Showgirls or something like that. But it's actually quite creepy. And I don't recommend ever watching Sextet, no matter how big a Ringo fan you are. Leave it alone.
There's a great podcast called Smersh Pods, which covers that film, which does it very well. They literally go through the whole film.
What, are they masochists? You're joking. What did they say about it then? Did they find it as irredeemable as you and I?
Of course, yeah. It's hilarious. It's the best review of a film I've ever heard. It's superb.
Is this leading to, well, Rob, you should try and watch it again? Because I'm not going to. Life's too short. Way too short.
I'm a fool to care when you treat me this way. I know I love you, but what can I do? I'm a fool to care.
Next we have a track arranged by old stalwart Klaus Voormann. It's I'm a Fool to Care, originally a hit for Les Paul and Mary Fords.
Is that right? I didn't know. I didn't know that. But I knew Fats Domino had done a version of it. I think with this one, well, I don't know. In terms of the few people now, sadly, still living, who can really tell you the real story about the Beatles, I've thought for a long time now, the person I would most like to talk to about the Beatles, more so than Paul or Ringo, is I'd like to talk to Klaus.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
He seems to have a clarity of memory and he doesn't seem to have a desire to put himself at the front of every story. He seems to be such a calm, kind man. I was lucky enough to go to Hamburg and interview Astrid about 10 years ago.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was for the British Airways magazine. And I flew out to Hamburg and I spent about 2 hours with Astrid, who was still in her beatnik polo neck, cropped haircut, smoking furiously. The time I spent with her was so valuable, you know, and I've never forgotten it. And it made me think that, yeah, the German contingent certainly seemed to have a perspective on the Beatles, which is, it always just seems, I don't know why, but it always just seems more truthful.
Yeah. Well, they saw the raw Beatles, didn't they? And you could have seen John as this rebel rocker, but they all saw beyond that, as you can see with the Jürgen Vollmer photos as well.
Yeah.
As Astrid's. And they saw a certain depth that a lot of people would have just disregarded. All of their greasy rockers.
Yeah, and when you look at what Klaus and Astrid did subsequently, they were always around. Astrid gave up photography almost completely in the mid-60s. But, and, you know, Klaus obviously became an extremely sought-after session musician. But they were never the ones elbowing themselves to the front of the queue to go on chat shows and say, I knew the Beatles. It's never been like that with them. And I think, yeah, Klaus is such a fascinating man. But, yeah, he knocks about with Ringo a fair bit on this album, actually, doesn't he? And also, we've got another little bit of Beatles alumni. We've got Billy Preston knocking it out of the park on the keyboards on this one. So I think this is, again, it's a well-chosen track for Ringo's voice. I think he was very well advised by Neil Aspinall and George Martin on what tracks to choose for this record. And it's just a great song.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody
haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration, but that was long ago. Now my consolation is in the stardust of a song.
Next we have a song that may or may not have been arranged by Paul McCartney. More likely it's George Martin, but it's Stardust.
Yeah, the oldest song on the album, I think. Hoagy Carmichael, I think it's about 1927, I'm going to go for. It's roughly right. And probably the most important song in terms of historical importance. The Library of Congress have archived this one. Lewison has commented that despite Macca supposedly arranging this, that George Martin submitted an invoice afterwards, which suggests that maybe kind of like the Family Way soundtrack, I would suggest Macca was on hand, but perhaps wasn't as involved as he would like us all to believe he was.
Yeah. The 7th of November, they did the backing and Ringo added his vocals a week later. That was oddly the same day as John and Yoko released the Wedding album. This is too diverse.
It's just so incongruous, isn't it? And yet, John and Ringo were, by some margin, I think, the Beatles who were closest to each other personally at around this time.
Mm.
You wonder how much support they were giving each other. John Lennon always went on record as saying when Paul and George were hostile to him and Yoko, Ringo was always okay. Him and Maureen were always okay. And you'd like to think that Ringo was listening to the Wedding album and going, yeah, I can see what you're doing there. Yeah, it's all right. And I don't think it was reciprocated, though, because that angry Rolling Stone 1970 interview, I think that's the time that Lennon calls Sentimental Journey embarrassing, or he said he was embarrassed by it, or something along those lines.
Yeah, he said a lot during that.
Well, he did, didn't he?
I think Rolling Stone as well, they would be asking loaded questions. They wanted a story.
Yeah, and also, you know, it was a time when he'd just come out of Janov therapy. I think his state of mind was unusually, when he was a fairly aggressive man, but particularly incendiary at that point. And he was just swinging punches left, right and centre. You know, George Martin got it. McCartney got it. Everybody got it in the neck in that interview. And you'd like to think it wasn't too long before Ringo and John made up after that. But yeah, Nat King Cole is the version that I've heard probably the most of Stardust. And it's really one of those songs where I think Ringo's vocal interpretation is pretty wobbly. It's not one of his better attempts on the album at all. But again, the charisma gets him through. It's a pleasure to listen to it. Just at the point where at the end and the climax, and he goes, "Hit me!" And he's just having the time of his life. And I can't help but grin when I think of Ringo just in the studio, just really letting himself go, and everything going on with the Beatles' divorce at the time. For a few hours there, he was in a different headspace, and he needed it.
Sundown, what will I do at dawn? What will I do at noontime now that I've found you gone? What will I do for sunshine with nothing but the rain? How can I smile, find life worthwhile?
Then we flip over to side two for a song arranged by Oliver Nelson, American jazz saxophonist, clarinetist, arranger and composer. It's Blue Turning Grey Over You.
Yeah, not one I'd heard at all until I first heard Sentimental Journey, and it left me scurrying around the internet to find a better known or earlier version that Ringo would have heard when he was a kid. I'd imagine it was probably the Louis Armstrong version that he would have heard. And yeah, I mean, I think there's generally a decline to Sentimental Journey inside too. I think it veers off and well, we'll come to it later, but it really crashes into a primary school towards the end. But there's on one track, but yeah, this is okay, but I'm not sure Ringo even liked this one very much. That there's not the same passion of delivery in this one. It's okay, but it passes me by slightly, I've got to say. What about you?
No, I agree. I think because he asked all of his family, didn't he? So I think a lot of them would have been, oh yeah, I remember that when I was a kid. I think this may have been one. He just doesn't seem that interested. He's struggling to hit the major and minor notes. Again, these songs, the melodies are so accurate. You know, if you fluff them, it's going to jump out.
Yeah, yeah. I think fluff is a good description for how he handles the vocals. And you get the impression he probably knocked this one off in two takes. I mean, I don't know, maybe he had crucial legal papers to sign about the, you know, the small matter of the Beatles breaking up at the same time. But you get the impression that he came in, did this, gave us a will this do, thumbs up. There's, I've got a car waiting. See ya.
Next, we have a Quincy Jones arrangement, Love is a Many Splendid Thing.
Yes, this is, my favourite sitcom of all time is Whatever Happened to the Lightly Lads. And the first time I think I ever heard this song was when there was a scene, Bob was having a row on the phone with Thelma, and Terry Collier's in the background witnessing this marital argument. And start singing, Love is a Many Splendid Thing, to Bob's intense annoyance, until eventually Bob goes and slams a tea cozy over his head. So that's when I first heard Love is a Many, Many Splendid Thing. It's not really my kind of tune. I think it's a little bit on the saccharine side. And let me say, obviously, my saccharine tolerance levels are pretty high for liking this album in the first place, but it goes a little too much for me on this one. It's Quincy Jones, isn't it? I think.
Yes.
Yeah, who did this one? I've never heard the number one hit version, which I think was by the Four Aces, which I haven't heard. There's a problem with this one, in my humble, utterly unqualified opinion, in that I think the backing vocals are raised way too high on this. The mix sounds awfully out of sorts.
See, I think it's a great mix. I think from Quincy Jones's perspective, he's been working with incredible singers and he's a good producer. He knows what he's doing. Maybe he heard vocals that weren't up to his usual standard. Mm. And it's a deliberate thing. I think those backing vocals, you can barely pick Ringo out. So as a production of a song, I think it's good. But for Ringo then to put it on his own album, it does highlight clearly what Quincy's been doing.
Yeah. Again, Ringo's out of his depth singing this one. And again, as I was saying earlier, that the saccharine levels, were really into Cliff Adams singers territory here, aren't we? And it feels it's a criticism that's been leveled at this record a lot, you know, particularly by the late Ian McDonald, who called the whole album maudlin, which isn't a description I agree with taking the album as a whole, but this track is a bit sludgy and a bit maudlin, and you clearly like it quite a bit more than me.
Yeah, I enjoy the bass. I do like that sort of 60s music you get in the background of, you know, all the girls dancing by the swimming pool as the old middle-aged men are smoking cigars, and you've got this kind of music.
Yes, do you think when the Profumo affair was going on, do you think they were listening to the old men around in Clifton? Yeah, you're right. That kind of vibe is somewhere malodorously there, isn't it?
Yeah. In 2018, Quincy described the Beatles. I love this. Saying they were the worst musicians in the world. They were no playing motherfuckers. Paul was the worst bass player I've ever heard. And Ringo, don't even talk about it. Ringo had taken 3 hours for a 4-bar thing he was trying to fix on a song. He's actually talking about this song. He couldn't get it. We said, mate, why don't you get some lager and lime, some shepherd's pie, and take an hour and a half and relax a little bit. And then Quincy claims that in the interim, he called English jazz drummer Ronnie Verrell into the studio. And again, this is another Quincy quote. Ronnie came in for 15 minutes and tore it up. Ringo comes back and says, George Martin, can you play it back for me one more time? So George did, and Ringo says, yeah, that didn't sound so bad. And I said, yeah, motherfucker, because it ain't you. Great guy, though.
Well, Quincy Jones likes a soundbite, doesn't he? And, you know, his reputation, for reasons that we won't go into, is somewhat tarnished, I think, these days. But, yeah, I'm unbelievably dubious about those quotes.
I have to agree.
It counteracts everything that has ever been said about Ringo's drumming ability, which is that he is the human metronome. And when you listen to Beatles in the studio doing endless takes of songs, whenever there's a mistake and they have to stop, it's never Ringo. Have you noticed that?
No. Yeah. Bear in mind, he actively chose not to play drums on this album as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why he would want to do that. He was a very young man. Why not push myself, perhaps fail, but have a go at see what else I can do? Those quotes by Quincy Jones can really get in the sea, as far as I'm concerned. I think that's absolute hogwash, and I'm not buying it for a second. Apart from the lager and lime and shepherd's pie, I can definitely believe in eating and drinking that.
Dream when you're feeling blue. Dream, that's the thing to do. Just watch the smoke rings rise in the air. You'll find your share of memories there.
Next we have a song arranged by George Martin, and oddly enough it's track number 9, and it's called Dream.
Oh, how odd. I'd never put that together, right? I love George Martin's arrangements. I'm one of the few Beatles fans who listens to side 2 of Yellow Submarine and absolutely adores it. And I think it's a gorgeous song. I don't really like the way that Ringo's voice is double tracked on it, but it's a very soft vocal, which Ringo, as we know, can do rather well. And I think it's a range that is comfortably within his capabilities. He's not straining on this one. But more than anything, it's like a gentle ocean wave. Him and George Martin have worked together for so long. It's a very sympathetic arrangement for Ringo's voice, and it shows exactly what the album could have been if there'd been a bit more time and coherence with the recording and mixing, and maybe not quite so much chopping and changing. I think there's a different arranger for every track. I think I would have liked George Martin to do half of them and the other half by different people.
George Martin's arrangement is superb because, again, he's counteracting Ringo's so-called limited vocals, but he's putting a lot of overlapping brass in there, and it's almost distracting the listener. So you're listening to the overall song rather than focusing on Ringo's vocals, and it's very sympathetically done.
Yes, it is. It is. There's a lushness to it. I mean, I know if we're going to be particularly, we're going to strain the metaphor or the simile to its dying breath. You know, there's something kind of culinary about it, and it's almost like a sort of gorgeously silky bouillabaisse, and you've got something raspy, like a little bit of, you know, parsley or garlic on top, and that's what Ringo's voice is. And I think it works tremendously on this track, and it's an absolute pleasure to listen to, and I wish all of the record was as good as this.
I'm picturing a nice trifle with a pickled onion in.
Some champagne with a bit of Scotch egg.
Sweetest rose and crush it until the petals fall.
Next, we have a track arranged by Johnny Dankworth, the English jazz composer, saxophonist, and husband to Cleo Skidlybap Lane. It's You Always Hurt the One You Love.
Yeah, it's another one I hadn't heard before Sentimental Journey, so I had no idea what Ringo's journey of his own to start adoring the track, or whatever member of his family told him they adored the track. Since then, I've heard versions of it, none of which I've liked. Peggy Lee, Pat Boone, Frankie Lane, didn't enjoy any of them. This is just purely personal for me. It's just, I'm not a fan of the song. I skip over this one purely because it leaves me cold, and in an album which is so warm and nourishing to listen to on a winter's night in so many ways, this one doesn't quite cut it. This is the one where I'll go to the kitchen and pour another glass of wine.
Same here. Track 11.
That's nothing else to say on that.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Could I tell you once again somehow? Have I told with all my heart and soul how I adore you, darling? I'm telling you now.
Track 11, arranged by none other than Elmer Bernstein, it's Have I Told You Lately That I Love You?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to start taking the whole album apart, this is where you start. You know, I mean, this is an absolute car crash. I mean, it is appalling. It should have been left on the cutting room floor and then removed from the cutting room floor as quickly as possible. It's a pity, but there's something kind of Austin Powers about this one. It's excruciatingly bad. Ringo is utterly out of his depth. I hate how up-tempo the forced jollity of it. It stinks the place out.
My note was a playful arrangement.
You're too kind. No, I mean it. You really are too kind. I wouldn't say he murders it, but
it's more manslaughter.
Yeah. He'll be out on parole in a few years. It's not life.
Kindest thing I could think of saying, it reminds me of a very late era Monkees song, possibly sung by Davy Jones.
It's absolutely barbarically awful. And if I was more articulate, I think I would get into a sort of Lester Bangs, a 45 word sentence critique of it. It's crap. And what a shame that the great Elmer Bernstein has to put this on his CV. Well, he probably doesn't have to, but it's on it, whether he wants it to be or not. Let's play it.
I guess if you've got Elmer Bernstein as on a credit, you're going to keep it, aren't you?
With someone like you, a pal so good and true, I'd like to leave it all behind and go and find some place that's known to God alone, just a spot to call.
And we close the album with a song arranged by Les Reed, who's a songwriter, arranger, best known for composing It's Not Unusual, Delilah and The Last Waltz. It's Let the Rest of the World Go By.
Yeah, he's echoing the end of the White Album here, isn't he? And not entirely unsuccessfully. I think it was written... Was it written for Petula Clark, I read while I was researching this?
No, this was written in 1919.
Oh, it's that old, is it, right? Okay. That makes sense, doesn't it? Well, I suppose what I'm intrigued of, what interested me in terms of getting into the minutiae of this being recorded was that on the very same day that he put down the vocal track for this, he also had a crack at a demo called Gotta Pay Your Dues, and that was retitled It Don't Come Easy, which obviously was an absolutely massive hit. So what's intriguing is that as he was recording this album, and you'd assume on the way to wrapping it up, he was already, whilst laying down the vocals for this, thinking about what he was going to do next, and that is just so brilliantly Beatles. You know, it's something you can attribute to all four of them, the sense of absolute impatience, of the carpe diem, of like, right, done, next, let's crack on. And I really think that's interesting, that the idea that he was floundering when he made this album. I don't think he was. I think he was really thinking, I'm going to dedicate a few months to this. And then, as we already know, he was already planning the country album. And then at this point, he was already thinking beyond that. You know, like a grandmaster chess player, you know, all the Beatles, I think at this, particularly at this point, and I think between 68 and 72, is by far the most interesting period for all four of them as individuals. And he even Ringo was playing like Kasparov. He was thinking many, many moves ahead, even at this point. And to be honest, it makes Sentimental Journey a lot more interesting to listen to when you're aware, or if you can be bothered, to look into that historical context.
Mm. Weirdly, It Don't Come Easy, he recorded three different versions during these sessions, and then he sat on it until October 1970, and then it wasn't released until the following year. Reminds me of the way George has done it. He's sat on songs for years that wouldn't appear. You know, Not Guilty would be another 11 years. Paul's done it.
But I don't think it premeditated enough to call this a long-term strategy, and that there's something, there's a whiff of the corporate to that, isn't there? Kind of a 5-year or a Soviet-style 5-year plan. I don't think there was anything like that. I think they were just bursting at the seams with ideas, and they just got them out in the order in which they felt like it. You know, I think they were driven very much by their heart's desire, and they were very lucky people. At this point in their lives, to have the finances and the creative freedoms to do exactly that. I don't think it was a long-term strategy. I think it was pretty haphazard, but that's the magic of the Beatles, is that they, certainly at this point in their career, everything they did seemed to be the right move. And in retrospect, you can argue that Sentimental Journey was a misstep, but if you broaden out and look at it from a slightly further perspective, I don't think it was a misstep at all. I think it was exactly the right thing for Ringo to do, and it was a hit. We need to come back to that. It sold a ton of records in the US. It reached number 7 in the UK. People might have been a bit confused by it, but they were confused by Two Virgins. They were confused by McCartney. They were confused in they were confused by Magical Mystery Tour. It's okay to be confused. I'd rather be confused than bored. And Sentimental Journey is, for the most part, not boring. And it's a very curious album that has an enormous amount of charisma attached to it. And I love the sleeve. I think there's such a proto kind of Martin Parr, Peter Mitchell, you know, those kind of making the mundane look monumental. And growing up near Liverpool, you know, I do know that pub.
I was going to say, have you been in the Empress?
Yeah, I've been. Actually, my friend Jamie, a school friend of mine who lives just off Penny Lane, I chatted to him last night to ask him if he knew what had happened with the Empress. And the latest he knew was that a fella called Kevin had taken it over and was planning on opening some of the rooms upstairs as hotel rooms, which seems like a fairly obvious idea. I think they've been missing a trick by not doing that a long time ago. But at the moment, it's obviously closed because of COVID. And I'm not sure if it is actually ever going to reopen or not. Let's certainly hope that it does. Although, if you have been in the pub in recent years, Elsie apparently worked there for a time, Ringo's mum. It's not a particularly interesting pub. It probably did have some character, but mostly it's been ripped out and it's quite modern inside and quite anonymous. It's not the pub you want it to be, put it that way.
Rob Crossan, thank you so much. I think the main question I need to ask, for people who've never, ever, ever wanted or probably still don't want to listen to this album, what would you say to them? What will people get from this album that they maybe hadn't thought that they would?
It's a really good introduction to the Great American Songbook. Not necessarily in terms of vocals, but in terms of the arrangements and how beautiful these songs can be, even when they're in the hands of a less than stellar vocalist. It speaks power to the timelessness of a collection of really beautiful songs, some of which are now almost a century old, and they haven't lost their emotional pull. It's also, if you're just generally fascinated by the Beatles, it's a great album in terms of understanding where they were at that particular time. And if you just like interesting photography of humdrum places, just buy a vinyl copy for the sleeve. It's ace.
Rob Crossan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.